Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie. I'm Charlotte Metcalf and today I'm delighted to be in conversation with the neurosurgeon Henry Marsh, who burst into my own consciousness when I read his extraordinary book Do No Harm back in 2014. Since then, he's become extremely well known. Earlier this year, BBC Two broadcast a Horizon documentary about him, and he's written two more books, Admissions, A Life in Brain Surgery, followed by And Finally in 2022. He has strong opinions on numerous issues, from the NHS and assisted dying to Ukraine, which he's visited frequently as a volunteer surgeon. Henry Marsh, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you very much.
Now, can we start with why you decided to become a brain surgeon? Because there's a very moving reason for this involving your son.
Well, it's complicated. I went into medicine late. I originally read PPE at Oxford. I did VSO in Africa. I had various part-time jobs. I worked as a nursing assistant. I worked as an operating theatre cleaner and porter. And at the end of it all, anyway, I decided I wanted to be a surgeon and abandoned. I suppose I was going to become a criminologist otherwise, because I specialised in Soviet politics. My main interest was in Eastern Europe and Soviet politics, and I did a special paper in it. So I wanted to be a surgeon, and then when I actually qualified as a doctor at the age of 29, although I'd had two very inspiring general surgical teachers as a student, Adam Lewis and Jerry Kirk, who were really very nice people, I didn't actually like surgeons on the whole very much. And also, surgery in those days meant any sort of general surgery. It was large incisions and body fluids. And I just didn't like it. I'm not squeamish, but I mean, it didn't appeal. And then my son had a brain tumour at the age of 3 months. He came close to dying, but it was benign, and he survived surgery, which, as I end up a paediatric brain surgeon myself, is fairly unusual at such a young age. And I was working on an ICU, and purely by chance I was helping an anaesthetist prepare a patient for a brain operation, and I saw an aneurysm operation, which I describe somewhere in my book as bomb disposal work for cowards. And I knew immediately what I wanted to do. As I say, it was a really epiphanic experience. I'm sure my son's tumour had played into it as well, but it was actually seeing a microscopic, deadly dangerous operation on the brain, which I thought, this is it. And I came home and said to my first wife, oh, I'm going to be a brain surgeon. And family and friends also rolled their eyes. Is Henry a brain surgeon? In the sense that, you know, Henry's always been very ambitious and driving and, you know, wants power and fame and everything else. So I have no regrets. It's a terrible life as a neurosurgeon. And I, with my books, I describe that.
You do, in great detail. And I was going to talk to you about that, because it does seem to be your... Everyone else's beck and call except your own.
Yes.
And you have no social life, really, because you can't.
When I was working, no. My colleagues, I still go into my hospital to teach occasionally. So I'm still very much in touch with the NHS. It's very different now. I mean, I was on call every third night, every third weekend, for the first few years as a consultant. As a trainee, I was on call all the time. But now my colleagues are on call only every 3 weeks, and they only operate 1 or 2 days a week. It's appalling. I mean, the NHS, it's another subject, but the NHS is really, it's gone seriously wrong. I hate sounding like an old man saying things are better in the past. Some things are better now. I mean, it's not all bad by any means. But my colleagues are all miserable, and they're younger. Mm. So it has gone. The NHS has really got into a real mess.
But the way you work very hard, which you recount so vividly in your book, how that had a pretty dire impact on your family life.
I think
life.
So, but it was my choice. And to make it worse, when I came home, rather than spend time with my wife or children, I'd spend the whole day doing sort of manic do-it-yourself building projects. I still suffer from it. I still do all my own building and plumbing and electricity and everything, and I got a bit better, perhaps, but it's I mean, this is the third documentary about me. I've had three BBC documentaries. I discussed it, and it was a failing on my part. I could have been a better father.
And so the son who had the
He's fine. He's now 44 years old, 45 years old. He's 46 this weekend. And he's okay.
And how many other children do you have?
I've got two daughters after my son. The son was the youngest. That's my first marriage. My second marriage to the anthropologist and writer Kate Fox. We haven't got any children, mainly because she's got very bad Crohn's disease. But she says she always wanted instant teenage daughters, and she got that. And also, Kate and I met after my marriage had ended, so it wasn't as though she was a woman who'd sort of broken the marriage.
No.
So she gets on very well with my children. I'm very, very happy about that.
And she perhaps escaped the worst of your...
Yes, she did.
..absolute head in the hospital.
Yeah. But even then, because I've kept my home in London, she lives in Oxford, and for various reasons does not like coming to London. So, I mean, I was in Ukraine for the last 2 weeks. I'm stuck in London for the next 2 weeks. In fact, she won't see me probably for a whole month. So in that sense, it's not that different, but she says she accepts that. And she accepts my obsession of Ukraine.
Yes, no, let's talk about that. When and how and why did that stop?
Well, I'm really rather proud of the fact that I've been going there since 1992, which gives me a certain status in Ukraine. I mean, all the world and its neighbour is going to Ukraine now, but I've been going there right from independence onwards. And that was a combination of the fact that I'd studied Soviet politics at Oxford. I never thought I'd combine criminology with brain surgery. But in effect, I did.
Was that the first time you'd been in 1992?
Yes. Gosh. I've been going back ever since.
Yes, I know.
I've been going back more frequently because of the war. I'm not a military or trauma surgeon, but I go both to cheer up my friends and also because I have some public status in Ukraine. And people like me going there. Somebody believes in them. Somebody thinks they have a future.
And where do you operate when you're there?
I stopped operating. I need a lecture now. Mm-hmm. I think the last operation I did was back before the pandemic in the children's hospital in Lviv. It's complicated, but my work now, and I was there for the last 2 weeks, I was lecturing at medical schools. I gave 7 lectures and 3 interviews in 2 weeks and travelled 2,000 kilometres, so it's quite busy. So I try to talk about mainly some ethical, psychological issues, about decision-making, about being nice to patients, which a lot of Ukrainian doctors aren't, about the importance of teaching. It's a very different culture, dating back to the Soviet time.
How interesting that they're quite brutal.
Can be. Well, all medical systems reflect their society, and the Soviet society in Ukraine, to some extent, is deeply hierarchical.
But you really like Ukrainians, don't you? Because you said you've got better friends there than...
Yes, I do. I am very English. I paraphrase G.K. Chesterton about inside every fat man, a thin man is struggling to get out. Inside every reticent, reserved Englishman, a sort of soulful Slav is struggling to get out. But also it's exciting, you know, when I go there, it's a bit shameful, but I know it was a fairly major air attack when I was in Kiev, and I find it exciting rather than frightening. I knew people were being killed, and that's horrible. Mm. But it also made me realise how, although my default position is I'm a rather anxious, cowardly sort of person, it's more complicated than that. I became a neurosurgeon because I like frightening myself. You know, it's the risk and danger which draws many people to become surgeons.
Well, let's talk a bit about that, because you've had some nasty feedback at times when things have gone wrong.
Mm. The weird thing is, Charlotte, that when I look back in my career, I cannot remember a single successful operation.
No.
At all. All I see is an ocean of failure. I know that's not true.
No.
I know that I help far more people than I hurt. But all I remember is the pain and hurt. And every day I will suddenly remember a patient. Sometimes I haven't remembered 30... Just today I was thinking about a patient from 35 years ago. I hadn't thought about it 35 years ago. Lurking in my unconscious where I felt I'd handled things badly. And often it's when I felt in retrospect I'd been unkind. You know, the huge, biggest problem in medicine, I think, is finding a balance between detachment and care. You have to, you know, you have to witness terrible suffering and not get frightened by it. You have to be detached, but not lose your kindness. And that's really difficult. And it's such a cliche. And because of my experience with my son, certainly when it came to dealing with the parents of children with brain tumours, I hope I did it well, as I knew what they were going through. Because you never get feedback. Nobody ever tells you why doctors are so often rather bad at talking to patients, particularly when things have gone badly for whatever reason, is you never get any comments or feedback. You never know how you're doing. So I suspect most doctors, including myself, think they're much better at talking to patients than they really are, because we never know.
Why don't you think you get feedback? Because you did
patients are all terrified. We don't want to criticise our doctors.
No.
You know, if the doctors have told you that the person you love is going to die soon, you don't ring them up and say, I didn't like the way you told me. No, it's a totally asymmetrical, corrupting relationship.
But
and
you
yet
were...
you have to be detached. You can't do the work if you're going to get all worked up.
No. But you were approached by somebody in the street, weren't you?
Purely by chance. I was accosted by this woman in the street whose child I'd operated upon 30 years ago. He was going to die anyway, and the mother herself knew that and said that. But they chose to blame me. She and her husband blamed me for the child's death for many, many years.
Why did they blame you?
Well, they had to blame somebody. I mismanaged it terribly when the tumour recurred. I refused to get a scan. I couldn't believe the tumour had come back. I was a very young consultant at the time, and, you know, I just couldn't believe it had gone badly. It had been a really difficult operation. I felt terribly pleased with myself. I was still very insecure and arrogant at the same time, which you are when you're a young consultant. Mm. You have to believe in yourself. You couldn't do the work.
No.
But yeah, it's very easy to believe in yourself too much.
Do you talk to other surgeons about all this stuff?
Well, I give lectures about it, yeah. I go around the world lecturing about mistakes, and I illustrate it with brain scans of patients I've wrecked or killed. Which, of course, goes
down... Oh, how gutting, though.
Well, I get used to it, but I love it. If you go to medical conferences, it's all about success. People say, I can do this, all the clever operations they've done. And if there's anything about bad results or failure, it's kind of hurried past very quickly in small print. But, of course, the whole point about the sort of surgery I did is it's bloody dangerous, and we learn by getting it wrong. And if you're not going to be open about this, you don't make much progress. I made some terrible mistakes. I did usually apologise. And it's amazing what you get forgiven for if you apologise. But to do that, to apologise, you have to get off your... You've got to climb off your pedestal. The pedestal the patients put you on, the pedestal you put yourself on, and you have to put yourself down to the same level as your patients and their families. And that's very difficult.
Do you regret choosing it as a career? I mean, it hasn't been an easy career.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a waste of time having regrets. I feel sad about many things I did and patients I failed and my first marriage. I'm very lucky that my three children, I have a good relationship with them still, despite I feel as an absentee father. I think I had an absolutely amazing life. But I like risk and danger and challenges, and that's what I got. But I've always, because I went into medicine late, and a bit of an intellectual compared to most doctors on average, because I had a proper education, so to speak, liberal education. I've always felt a bit of an outsider, and also because my mother, who was a political refugee on the left from Germany, her sister in the middle was a keen Nazi.
My uncle was
a Luftwaffe Messerschmitt fighter pilot. But my mother had to leave Germany in a hurry, basically, because she was in trouble with the Gestapo for having anti-Hitler opinions. And my father was a very, rather eccentric human rights lawyer, deeply idealistic man.
How did they meet?
He'd gone to Germany to learn German.
Uh-huh.
And my mother wouldn't join the Bundesdeutsche Mädel, the women's equivalent of the Hitler Youth. So she was training as a bookseller in Halle. And they met, and my father was the first person my mother could talk to about the fact she knew the Nazis were bad.
That's so interesting.
So, in retrospect,
Which was dangerous to talk like that.
Oh, no, she got denounced at the Gestapo. Yeah. And her two friends who were sent to prison. But in retrospect, I can see I was brought up, particularly by my mother, who was very sort of reserved in a very German Lutheran way, with a sort of deep disrespect of authority. And my father was an odd mixture of conformist and nonconformist. And I think I've had that slightly attitude towards the medical profession.
How did he get your mother out of Germany?
By marrying her, basically.
He married her and then brought her here?
Yes.
Yeah. Gosh, and what did he do, your father?
Well, he was one of the first law commissioners. He was He was an Oxford law don, but found that a bit too Olympian and oppressive. But basically, he only practiced at the bar before. Basically, he was an academic lawyer, but one of the earliest of international human rights lawyers.
And did your mother ever take you back to Germany?
No, I did. Shortly before she died, my brother and I took her back to Magdeburg and Halle. She went back occasionally, but she'd lost everything. All her family, it was a small family, all died in the war.
Including her Nazi sister?
Yeah, she got killed in air raid in Vienna.
Oh.
And then we went back to the street in Magdeburg where she grew up. It wasn't just the house had gone, the whole street had gone, because January the 24th, I think, in 1945, bombed the whole Magdeburg to bits.
Did you grow up speaking German?
No, I'm the only member of my family who doesn't speak German. It's a source of great self-criticism.
Did she not speak it to you then?
No, because I'm the youngest of four, and my sisters were born during the war, and my mother said she didn't feel like speaking German to them when German bombs were falling on London.
So that it's interesting that you had a mother who acted completely on principle rather than on any innocent...
Totally on principle.
Yeah.
And, I mean, her parents, or their father had died in 1936. My mother said she didn't particularly have political discussions with her parents, but my mother just knew it was wrong.
Good for her.
I know, remarkable, quite remarkable.
So that you've had that instilled in you as well?
I think a certain non-conformism, yes, which applies applies to my views to the medical profession to a certain extent as well.
Yes.
And to myself, you know. Yeah. I criticise myself for my medical attitudes.
Yeah, and so going back to Ukraine for a minute, you know, how do you feel about that war?
It was awful. There is a deep wish, particularly among the younger generation who have been born since independence, to live in a liberal democracy.
Mm.
And although Putin and co. dress up their invasion on the grounds of sort of Slavic Brotherhood and neo-Nazis, ultimately a free, successful, democratic Ukraine is a deadly threat to kleptocratic autocracy,
yes,
which is what Russia has been for generations.
Yes.
But there's no doubt that Putin is driven by a deep resentment of the West, which predates, it gets back to Peter the Great. Russia's always had a deep inferiority complex vis-à-vis the West and hatred. I've always been mad about Russian culture. That's when I was working. I was rather keen on communism at one point. But it's, you know, Ukraine is a more or less democratic state. It doesn't want to be ruled by Russia, as it is. My friends all know what that would mean.
So what now?
What now? My cancer might be coming back, so I've been having to think a lot about that. I'm just awaiting the next set of tests. Which I find difficult, but I'm getting better at coping with it, because I was looking up my life expectancy at the age of 75, which is only 8 years anyway, so fuck off, Marsh. Why are you getting so worked up about that? Your prostate cancer's probably coming back. And it is an absurd aspect, I think it applies to most of us as one gets older. You just find it very hard to accept that life is finite, you know?
Yes.
And you get I'm frightened by my cancer. But in fact, if I had the choice of dying from cancer in 5 years' time and from dementia in 10 years' time, I'd definitely opt for cancer in 5 years' time. Not that we have that choice. But I get better. My wife calls it therapeutic catastrophizing. I go through a period of intense anxiety and trauma, and then I kind of come out the other end, all right, let's get on with things, you know. And I'm 75. I've lived longer than many of my patients. I'm still physically quite well. And you have to learn to live in the present.
You're very fit. You cycle everywhere, don't you?
Yeah, I cycle everywhere. I had a knee replacement a few months ago, So I can't, I'm not running very much at the moment. But yes, I, but you know, the physical fitness is just about as close to having a panacea as we have.
Yeah. So, assisted dying.
Mm. Now, I mean, great, I've got to give evidence to the House of Commons Select Committee on Human Rights next week because of the argument that disabled people will be coerced, which is one of the, that is quite, is one of the arguments brought up by the sort of Catholic religious pressure groups against assisted dying to justify their deep opposition to it. We're allowed by the Mental Capacity Act, I think of 2004, to say I don't want any more treatment. I'm allowed by law to say I don't want to be treated, I'd rather die. But I'm not allowed to say when or where or how, which seems to me a pretty major inconsistency. And what's so striking when you read the English, very vocal minority opposed to it, it's entirely hypothetical. They refuse to look at what happens in other cases. It's typical British insularity, you know. Look, they've had assisted dying in Switzerland, in Belgium, in Holland for donkey's years. Where is the evidence that this is leading to abuse? Why is it none of the countries who have assisted dying have gone back and revoked it or had second thoughts? But it's a combination of English insularity, which I've always hated, partly being half German, and also a lot of it's, it's an argument ad hominem, but a lot of the most fanatical opposition you will find are from Catholic pressure groups. They masquerade under various names like the Anscombe Centre for Bioethics, but in fact it's a Catholic front organisation. You know, fair enough, they have a deep faith, but somehow life at any cost. But as a practical doctor, medicine's about the relief of suffering. It's not just about prolonging life. And anyway, in medicine, we're making decisions every day to stop treatment. We don't try to keep people alive forever and ever on ventilators or things like that.
Do you have faith?
No, certainly not. Absolutely impossible, I think, to be rational neurosurgeon. I'll tell you why. First of all, you see horrible things happening.
Yeah.
And I saw lots of children dying horribly from trauma, from brain tumours, things like that. You can't say they smoked or they drank too much.
No.
Or, you know, maybe they came from the lower classes, because you know ill health is very closely tied up with class and wealth, or poverty, rather. So you have to say it's not their fault. How can the benign God, you know, do this, allow such awful suffering for the parents? As you know, losing a child is, you know, one of the worst things that can happen to one. I came close to it. But,
yes.
So what? How do the religious... Well, you either say, oh, God works in a very mysterious way. Or you say, well, there's a friend of little children above a bright... We'll all be right afterwards. There's an afterlife. But you see, the problem in neurosurgery is you see people with frontal brain damage, which is where the moral, social bits of the brain lurk. And I've seen many, many people over the years of profound personality change, almost invariably for the worse, where they lose all their sort of moral meaning on their social life. I've seen children who've been turned into little sort of zombies. So it's impossible, really, unless you have complete cognitive dissonance, to believe that we aren't our brains, that our brains don't obey the laws of physics. The fact that the laws of physics tell us nothing about how consciousness arises from physical matter is I think, tremendous. You have to accept when we die, our brains die, and that's the end. There's no afterlife. Therefore, there is no benign deity.
So how are you going to cope with your fear if...
Well, I have coped with it by looking up the statistics on my life expectancy and realising, A, that it's not very different from having my recurrent prostate cancer. It's not definitely recurrent yet, but it probably is. And I sort of dread what treatment may be required. I didn't like being on castration hormone treatment for 2 years, but I may well get plonked back on that. And secondly, I've never really wanted to live in decrepit old age. Yes, there are a few exceptions like David Attenborough and the various people who are very fit and well in their 80s and 90s, but they're a minority. Life is all about probabilities.
Yeah.
By the age of 85, we have a 45% risk of Alzheimer's. And the older we get...
45%?
Yeah. Thanks.
Is that right now?
I think so.
That's huge.
It's really high. Check it out. I mean,
that's enormous.
That's the figure. Alzheimer's is an age-related disease. Yes, lifestyle reduces your risk a bit, but the older you get, the more likely you are to have it. I find that conversation between Xi Jinping and Putin, the one about organ transplants, did you see that?
No.
There was an outtake and the microphone had been left on, and they heard discussing the fact that organ transplants of young people can keep one living much longer.
Oh.
You're quite creepy.
That's really scary. They're going to have farms of... That's really,
well, I think
really
China was using organs from executed prisoners.
Oh, my goodness.
For transplants.
Mm. So are you feeling optimistic about the rest of your life now, however long that may be?
Yeah, because the rest of my life is getting on with today, living in the present.
Yes, living in the present.
Things can only get worse. I feel totally pessimistic about the future for my grandchildren.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. The climate change.
Climate change.
I follow all, I read the New Scientist magazine. And, you know, all the worst case scenarios are playing out at the moment. And then when you have climate change now in America and all the big greenwashing fossil fuel companies now backing off even on their little greenwashing activities. And what's so tragic is it's all the poor countries who will pay the price, like Jamaica, totally flattened.
Yes.
Unbelievable floods in Pakistan, in Sindh, again a country I know. And they contribute nothing to climate change. It's all been the first world historically.
What's there to look forward to for your grandchildren? Not a lot.
Not a lot.
No.
But they're all happy. I think they get told a little bit about climate change and all that. But children have a natural optimism, you know, which is wonderful. Which is why you think of Gaza and also Ukraine, a whole generation of children who have been profoundly traumatised, if not killed. But one must all go on trying to throw one. The little pile I throw my pills on is trying to make doctors a bit more insight, a bit nicer. So I'm very lucky I can go on lecturing and feel like I'm trying to contribute a bit. But in terms of the big things like climate change and, you know, the retreat of liberal democracy, obviously I can do nothing much about it.
No, well, you have done a lot for medicine.
Well, I hope so. I hope maybe... And doctors do like my book, particularly the first one.
Yeah.
There's no question of that. And I had so many people that would approach me at meetings or write to me saying they'd find it so helpful to hear me talking about my terrible mistakes I'd made.
I think what's so interesting about what you've done there with your books is it's a bit like when Anthony Bourdain wrote Kitchen Confidence.
Oh, yes, you know, he killed himself, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, nobody knew anything about chef,
yeah,
and it was so riveting.
Just an awful lot of Michelin star chefs do kill themselves,
yeah,
don't they?
And you know, one had no idea about the rigours of that profession or the horrors of, and the same with you, you know, the way you wrote about it was just so visceral, and you could... we were all in your head in that book.
Yeah. Well, I mean... I was taught to write, you know, because I had a good education right from the start. I was having to write essays and stories. And I keep a diary every day of my life. I've done since the age of 12, and I've thrown most of it away, I think, to my children's relief. But I'm always writing, you know, and it's trying to... if I could write one good sentence a day just describing something, I think I've achieved something. So writing all the time helps. But then I got a wonderful critic in the shape of Kate, my wife, who's a very, very good writer.
Well, Henry Marsh, thank you so much for coming on Radio Aldi. It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Henry Marsh. If you've enjoyed listening to this conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldi.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my thanks very much again to Henry Marsh, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL.